I have put an introductory background on the blackboard, and I have called that Roman numeral number 1. Would you therefore, on page 134, take the old Roman numeral number 1 and turn it into Roman numeral number 2? And then on page 136, if you would take Roman numeral number 2 and turn it into number 3, that will then get this plugged into the main outline system. First of all, some useful definitions as we consider the question of Ellen White and the use of modern translations or versions. There are two words that need to be defined: translation and paraphrase. I have defined translation as an exact, literal, word-for-word rendering of the biblical text. A translation. An exact, literal, word-for-word rendering of the text. And of course, we're talking today about texts in English or American. Those are two different languages, and if you don't believe it, you go visit England sometime. If you ask someone at the table for a napkin, if they look shocked, remember that what we call a diaper, they call a napkin. What we call a napkin, they call a serviette. On an automobile, they do not call it a hood, they call it a bonnet. They do not call it a trunk, they call it a boot. They do not call a fender, they call it a wing. And windscreen for windshield, that's pretty close. An elevator is a lift. A flashlight is a torch. The English language is not the American language. A jeweler in Antwerp, Belgium, one time had a sign in his window: English spoken, American understood. That was told to me by an Englishman with obvious relish. So we're talking about English and American translations at this point. So a translation, an exact, literal, word-for-word rendering of the text. Now, by contradistinction, paraphrase, we would call a loose idea for word. The other one was a strict word-for-word, literal, exact word-for-word. But this is a loose idea for word rendering of the text. And the two examples of a paraphrase which come most quickly to mind would be Phillips' paraphrase in 1958, J.B. Phillips, and Kenneth Taylor's Living Bible, which came out in 1971. So those are paraphrases. Translations, of course, the King James Version, which was not the first English translation. And by the way, it's interesting to me today to realize that the King James Version, which came out in 1611, was preceded by the Tyndale and Wycliffe translations, and a lot of people didn't like KJV. They said, let's stay with the old. Today there are a lot of people who don't like the modern ones, and they say, let's stay with King James. In fact, one man said, if it was good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me. Paul never saw it, no. It came 1,500 years after Paul was around. English and American translations in the 17th century, 1611, we have the King James. In the 19th century, we have the Revised Version, the RV, 1881 for the Old Testament, 1885 for the New, and the American Version, 1901. And then, of course, in the early 20th century, we had translations by Moffat, Weymouth, and Goodspeed. And then, beginning about 1949, we had the present generation, beginning with Ronald Knox, a Roman Catholic, Monsignor, 1945, the Revised Version, Revised Standard Version, RSV, in 1952, the Amplified in 1965, the Jerusalem Bible in 1966, the Barclay Translation in 1969, the New English Bible and the New American Bible in 1970, New American Standard in 71, NIV in 73, and today's English version, in 76. So those are all modern, recent modern translations. Now, point two in the background. The potential danger in a paraphrase is that a thought might be added that was not in the mind of the Bible writer, or a thought that was in his mind might be omitted. So you have either the addition or the omission of a thought in a paraphrase. William T. Hyde, who for many years graced the religion department of Pacific Union College, and during the 11 years that I taught there, most of those years he was teaching there, William Hyde has a gift for incisive categorizations, and he characterized the paraphrase very neatly. He said, a paraphrase is not a Bible. A paraphrase is a sermon on the Bible. Now, that's about as good as I've seen. This does not mean that a paraphrase is worthless. I have gotten great blessing and benefit from the paraphrase of Phillips and the paraphrase of Kenneth Taylor, which is known as Living Bible. But paraphrases do have potential dangers. You remember that little girl whose name was Topsy? When she was good, she was very, very good, and when she was bad, she was horrid. Well, most of these paraphrases are like that. Kenneth Taylor's paraphrase, when it's good, it's very, very good, but when it's bad, it's terrible. Ecclesiastes 9, 5, and 6, when the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything, he has a footnote in his Bible which says to the effect that Solomon didn't really mean this, he was just in a blue funk that day, and that his statement here does not reflect Bible truth. The problem is, it doesn't reflect his concept of Bible truth, which is the immortality of the soul. And incidentally, Taylor is honest enough, in the next to the last paragraph of his preface to Living Bible, he has a paragraph, the next to the last one, in which he points out, quite honestly, the potential pitfalls that a paraphraser's theology will color his paraphrase. And he illustrates this beautifully in Ecclesiastes 9, 5, and 6. Okay, point three in the background. The original languages in which the Bible texts were written, in the Old Testament, most of it was in Hebrew. There were portions of the book of Ezra and portions of the book of Daniel that were written in Aramaic, which is a dialect of Hebrew. And it's sort of like Yiddish today, Aramaic. Portions of Ezra, portions of Daniel. The New Testament was not written in classical Greek. It was written in Koine Greek, which was the street language of the time. Street Greek, not classical Greek. Now, there are two reasons, point number four in the outline, two reasons why new translations were felt to be needed periodically. First of all, continuing archaeological discoveries of additional ancient manuscripts of the Bible text bring to light new varieties. And then there is the evolution of language itself. Every language evolves. And the general nature of that evolution is from a general meaning to a precise meaning. And I'm going to give you several examples of that. The word conversation. Peter and Paul, in their epistles, speak about let your conversation be so-and-so. And you read that today, and you read conversation, and you think, well, it's a oral discourse between a couple of people, conversation. And that's what it means today. It has a much narrower meaning today than it had back in 1611. In 1611, the word conversation had a much more broad meaning. It meant your whole way of life. So when Paul and Peter say, let your conversation be so-and-so, they are not just talking about your words, that's included, but they were talking about a lot more. But you will not get that from the King James Version of the Scriptures. You need a more modern translation. Another example is the word meat, M-E-A-T. In 1611, the word meat meant food. It was synonymous with food. Later on, remember, the words, the general evolution of words, the meaning, goes from a broad meaning to a progressively narrow meaning. And so the word meat went from food down to a certain category of food, flesh foods. It has continued to be even more narrowed because today, strictly speaking, this is not so much true among Adventists, but out in the world, the word meat does not cover poultry and it does not cover fish. So today, if you just read the word meat in the Bible, in English, King James English, you might get quite a different meaning from what was originally intended. Incidentally, there are some archaic expressions in the English language. I'm talking about another word pronounced meat, M-E-E-T. It was meat, M-E-E-T. In Genesis 2, the creation of Eve, she was created to be an help meat for him. And some people think, well, meat is just an Old English equivalent of mate. She was to be a help mate. That isn't what it meant at all. That isn't what it says. The word meat today has a different meaning. It means appropriate, or appropriate to, or designed for. She was to be an help, and if they put a comma there, it would make it more clear, a help, comma, meat for him, fitting for him, appropriate for him. When the father of the prodigal son talked to the elder brother, who was upset and wouldn't even go in because they were having a feast for this profligate, he said to the older brother, he said, it was meat, M-E-E-T. It was appropriate. It was fitting. Words change their meaning, you see. It was fitting. Today, we don't use that word, M-E-E-T. We use that like you're meeting somebody on the street. Point 5 in the outline. There are 3 kinds of manuscripts or types or categories that have been discovered. There have been small fragments. As far as I know, the oldest is the John Ryland's Fragment of John, which was found about 114 A.D., if I'm not mistaken, a portion of the Gospel of John. I think that, at least for some years, was the oldest New Testament manuscript. Then there were extended passages, and then there were whole books. Point 6, problems for scholars. There are several problems. One is that there is no original autograph, that's the technical term. The book that Moses wrote, the book of Job that he wrote, the book of Genesis that he wrote, the book of Exodus, the very book that he wrote was called the autograph. There are no autographs in existence today. And so that is a problem. All we have today are copies, and copies of copies of copies of copies, which presents some problems. The second problem arises out of the first one. Among the numerous manuscripts that we have, there are different variant readings for the same passage. So point number 7, the goal of the scholars is to get back to the earliest manuscript in the hope that it will be the least corrupted by copyists' mistakes that crept in over the years. Now, number 8, there are 2 different kinds of copyist errors that we might mention here that crept into subsequent copies. Copies were made in 2 ways. A man might have a text in front of him and he would copy, and his eye would follow along and then copy. If his eye missed a whole line, then there would be an omission and also a very strange construction. And incidentally, we discovered an Ellen White manuscript that had been copied off by a typist in which this is illustrated, and the copyist left out a whole line. And therefore, it makes a sentence read something very strange that Ellen White didn't intend. And somebody wrote to us and said, what does this mean? We checked it out, and we found out that the copyist had skipped a whole line in typing up the manuscript. So we were able to help that person. So when copyists are working one-on-one, there is the danger that they may skip a line or two, or, of course, also leave out a word. Then the other way that copies were made in the Bible times, educated slaves were put in book factories that were called scriptoria. And there would be one slave who would read out loud the text of the thing, and then there might be a dozen people who would copy as the man read very slowly. But there are some words which sound alike, which are different. Take the word two. You have T-O, T-O-O, and T-W-O. They all sound the same. And he might be reading T-O, and somebody would put down T-W-O. Well, often you can pick those up without too much difficulty, but these are called orthographic errors, and some of those would creep into the text. Now, point number 9, there are 4 categories. There are 4 categories of Bible texts, four groupings of biblical texts. There is the Byzantine, which also is known as the majority text, because it's the largest group of manuscripts, and it was from the Byzantine that the King James Version was translated. Then there was the Alexandrian text, which some Bible scholars believe was the most pure. Third, there was the Western text, which was a collection of manuscripts older than the Byzantine, but containing some very bizarre readings. And then lastly, there was the Caesarean text. These are the four main categories or groupings of Bible texts in manuscript form. Now, back to translations, modern translations. There are two types. There are those which are done by one man. Taylor did his, of course, his wasn't a translation, it was a paraphrase. Taylor gave us Living Bible. Phillips gave us Letters to Young Churches, and so on. A one-man project, it may not be as accurate as a group project. There is in La Habra, California, an organization called the Lachman Foundation. In the 1960s, the Lachman Foundation gave us the Amplified Bible, which was a very good study Bible, but it was terrible for oral reading. And so they later brought out another Bible, which was better for oral reading, called the New American Standard. And the Lachman Foundation employed, I don't know, 50 or 60 people, I guess, to work on that project. And that kind of a translation is usually safer than a one-man type. The last point on the outline are some problems and issues for fundamentalists. The basic premise of many fundamentalists is that the transmission of inspired material through revelation was done on a verbal or mechanical basis, that all the prophet did was take dictation. That is not the way it happened in Bible times, and that's not the way that Ellen White talked about it. I think you've had a lecture last week, didn't you, on inspiration, revelation, that sort of thing, so we won't need to elaborate on that. Many of the fundamentalists have the belief that truth is found only in the Byzantine text. Therefore, the King James Version, which is based on the Byzantine text, they hold is the only accurate representative or representation of the Bible text in the English language. Furthermore, they allege that liberal scholars have polluted and corrupted the Bible text to suit their own theological predilections, and therefore the modern translations are not safe. And of course, they have a hard time explaining one irony, and that was that the Sabbath was changed to Sunday in the Byzantine Empire, whereas the Copts in Alexandria in Egypt were the ones who preserved the Sabbath. Okay, with that as an introduction, you can turn now to page 134 in your outline. And we will proceed with materials that we have there. By way of introduction again, we note that with cyclical regularity, there have appeared in conservative, Christian, and SDA circles dark hints and conspiracy theories that modern language translations of the Scripture are really a Machiavellian conspiracy by the Church of Rome and or the Jesuits and or theological liberals to subvert by changing the faith once delivered to the saints. In our own church, in the 1930s, waves were created by an Adventist educator, Dr. B.G. Wilkinson, who wrote extensively defending the King James Version from skeptical and apostate inroads produced by subsequent modern language translations. Recently, similar sentiments have again been expressed in more recent times, and an article appeared in a publication about a year ago which reviewed Wilkinson's work and accepted many of his conclusions. A number of good and loyal, if we might say misinformed, Adventist ministers and laymen almost seemed to take the position expressed in the well-known canard that if the King James was good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me. There is a church that's not 40 miles from where we're sitting right now. There is a church in Michigan in which on Sabbath morning the local elder will start Sabbath school out by saying not, "How many of you brought your Bibles? Hold up your Bibles." But he will say, "How many of you brought your King James Bibles? Hold up your King James Bible." Implying that there is inferiority and even danger in any other version of the Scriptures. This is popular in some Adventist circles. The presentation which follows will examine the background of the controversy and the practice and teaching of Ellen White on this subject. You know, of course, that there were very few modern language translations available in her day. The modern day publishing explosion seems to have been begun in the 1940s with Knox in 1945. In her day, there were few, but she quoted from them in her published works as soon as they came out. Also, nowhere is there any record of Ellen White sounding dire warnings against subversion that would be wrought by conspiracy-originated false modern language translations, and the manner in which she used such translations in her writings is itself both interesting and instructive. Now, Roman numeral number 2 here, it is 1 in your outline, but since we gave you a new Roman numeral number 1, the 1 in your outline is now Roman numeral number 2, the Arthur White Statement of December 9, 1953. Arthur White prepared a statement on the teaching and practice of Ellen White on December 9 of 1953. It was originally published in the book Problems in Bible Translation, pages 65 to 73, a book published by the General Conference, now out of print, but if you're near a good library, they probably would have a copy. It has been reprinted as a shelf document, and if you want a copy, check with Elder Fagel, White Estate here on campus. It is a shelf document, and what we have now was revised by the author in May of 65, 12 years later. A little bit of additional textual material was added, and the reference sources were updated. In the original, Selected Messages, Book 1, had not been published, and so there are manuscript references where now the shelf document would have the references in 1SM. Willie White, the father of Arthur White and the son of Ellen White, who was his mother's counselor and confidant and helper in the later years of her life after the death of James White, Willie White reported that just prior to the publication of the revised version, it's the English Revised Version, but it goes by RV. That is not recreation vehicle. The New Testament came out in 1881. The Old Testament came out in 1885. Now, prior to the publication of the English Revised, reports of the nature of the changes that were going to be affected in the text were leaked to the public press, and I think probably leaked by the publisher. This was designed to create curiosity and interest and whet the appetite for purchase of the book when it came out. And Willie saw these articles in the public press, and he called them to the attention of his mother. And by his own admission, he rather expected her to be negative. And to his surprise, she was not negative, she was positive. He said, "I was surprised by her response." And he said, "She led me to believe that the new versions, when available, would be of substantial service to the White Estate." Now, of course, it wasn't called White Estate before her death, but to the work of her office. Page 135. Ellen White began to use passages from both the English Revised. Remember, the Old Testament came out in 1881, the New Testament in 1885. She began to use passages from both of these, and also from the American Revised, which came out in 1901, as soon as these writings were commercially available in print, as soon as these versions. During the decade between the publication of the two versions on either side of the Atlantic, See, the Old Testament RV came out in 1891, and in that next decade, 1881 to 1891, eight articles were published in the Review and Herald between 1880 and 89 of an informational nature concerning progress of the translators and background concerning their work. Incidentally, none of these eight articles were negative or hinting at subversive dangers to be found in these new translations. At the same time, an additional four articles came from Ellen White's pen, comprehensive and illuminating, which would not only reveal Ellen White's philosophy of inspiration, but would also pave the way for her use of these new versions in her writings. They are listed there for you. One in 1886, two of them in 1888, one in 1889, two of them now in Selected Messages Book 1, one in Great Controversy, the Introduction to Great Controversy, and one in Volume 5 of the Testimonies. Then there were subsequent materials, 1889 and 1901, which appeared in at least one of them in print now. Ellen White occasionally used the revised version, the RV, in her writings. She also used marginal renderings, which were interpretations, if you please, translations of a word into more modern English. And she used these in nearly all of her books published after 1885. That was the year that the complete RV was first available. In the Great Controversy of 1888, seven texts from the new RV were incorporated. Also, the marginal renderings of eight other textual passages. In Great Controversy, there are about 850 Bible references, roughly one to a page. And the references to either the RV or marginal renderings are roughly one to 100 pages. In the 1911 edition of Great Controversy, which Ellen White supervised, one of the previously used seven references in the RV was changed to an AV, or American version, rendering. In Ministry of Healing, which came out in 1905, Ellen White used eight texts from the RV, 55 from ARV, two from Leeser, four from Noyes, and seven additional marginal renderings. And then other Ellen White books which came from the press, which have frequent usages of more modern translations, Patriarchs and Prophets, Steps to Christ, Mount of Blessings, Desire of Ages, Education, and Volume 8 of the Testimonies. There are seven books which came out after 1900 in which there are comparatively few RV or AV renderings, Christ Object Lessons, Volume 7 and Volume 9, Acts of the Apostles, Counsels to Teachers, Gospel Workers, and Prophets and Kings. Willie White, Ellen White's son and close companion and counselor for many years, made a statement concerning his mother's use of modern language versions in 1931, and it appears at the top of page 136. I'm not going to read all of this. You can read it at your leisure. I would point out that he starts out in the second paragraph by pointing out that when they became available, he got his mother a good copy. She referred to it occasionally. She did not use it in her preaching. She did use it in a number of her writings, but she didn't in her preaching. And so he asked her why she didn't use it in her preaching. And the last paragraph in the middle of the page, 136, the last paragraph here gives you what she said. There are many persons in the congregation who remember the words of the text we might use as they are presented in the Authorized or King James Version. And to read from the RV would introduce perplexing questions in their minds as to why the wording of the text has been changed by the revisers and why it was being used by the speaker. She did not advise me in a positive way not to use the ARV, but she intimated to me quite clearly it would be better not to do so in preaching, as the use of different wording brought perplexity to the older members of the congregation. And I imagine that some of you are saying at this point, well, if she didn't use it in preaching for that reason, why did she use it in writing? I think I know the answer. in preaching, you have to continually follow what the man is saying, don't you? You don't have time to stop, think, go back over what he said. But when you're reading a book, you can stop at any point. You can go back, you can review, you can ponder, and then you can pick it up and go on. But in preaching, you have to follow right along with the preacher. And if someone was using an unfamiliar rendering, the person might start wondering, what did they do that for? And miss the next 15 or 20 sentences, you see. Whereas in reading, you can stop at any point. You can reflect. You can go back. You can read it again. You can ponder it. Whereas in listening to a sermon, you have to keep up with the preacher. I think that may be one reason at least. Now, the Roman numeral 2 becomes Roman numeral number 3. There's a little typographical error in the heading. It should be EGW, not EGD. How Ellen White used modern translations in her writings. First, most who have dealt with Ellen White's use of modern translations, and there are not very many in that group, most have focused in quantitative aspects. You know, how many times did she use it, where did she use it, and so on. Not very many so far have dealt with the how question, and you might write in the why question. The how and the why. In what follows, we will examine two ways in which Ellen White used these materials, which I think will be very useful. First of all, she used modern translations to provide for a variant meaning. Now remember, the Bible writers did not write in English. They wrote in Hebrew and Aramaic in the Old Testament. They wrote in Koine Greek in the New Testament. And the words in those languages often have more than one legitimate possible translation. Okay, at the bottom of page 136, Ellen White's handling of Philippians 2:7 is an interesting case study to examine, because in Desire of Ages, she uses the same verse, Philippians 2:7, from two different translations. And the purpose is to make two entirely different yet legitimate points on the basis of the original Greek words involved. Now, in the King James Version, and at the bottom of the page, you have a quotation from 436, Desire of Ages. The King James Version translates this, "He made himself of no reputation." What are the King James translators who translated it that way? And that is a legitimate translation. It is not the only legitimate translation. What point were the translators of the King James Version trying to make at this point? They were dealing with what we could call the bastardy issue. In the eyes of his contemporaries, Jesus was an illegitimate child. He was a bastard. The Jews were very concerned about pure bloodlines. In Deuteronomy, there is a passage which said, "A bastard shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord even until the 10th generation." Now, that did not mean that an illegitimate child could not go to church. That meant that he couldn't have his name recorded in the annals of Israel until the 10th generation. So the Jews were very concerned about that. And four times in Desire of Ages, Ellen White focuses on the bastardy issue. Four times. The first time she focuses on it was when Jesus was a little child playing in the sawdust chips of his father's carpenter shop. And the townspeople from Nazareth would go by, and they would see the little baby, little boy, infant playing there, and they would smile to each other and say, with a rising inflection of the voice, "Is not this Joseph's son?" As much as to say, well, maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. Joseph was not viewed as the human father of Jesus. And there was speculation, had Mary had an affair with a Roman soldier, or with a peasant boy, or with somebody else? It was generally agreed that Joseph was not the biological father. He was the legal father of Jesus, but he was not the biological father of Jesus. And so they raised that question when Jesus was just a small child. Then Ellen White goes on in Desire of Ages in two places to point out that during the ministry of Jesus, his so-called illegitimacy was thrown in his face. On one occasion, and both of these are in the Gospel of John, by the way, in one occasion, Jesus said to the Pharisees and the scribes, the ecclesiastical leaders, He said, you brag that you are the children of Abraham, that Abraham is your father. Well, you certainly are the children of your father, but your father is the devil. Your father isn't Abraham, and the work of your father you do very well. Immediately they shot back and they said, we be not born of fornication. In other words, they were trying to destroy Jesus' credibility in the minds of the people around. Then the fourth instance in which Ellen White raises the bastardy issue is when Jesus hung on the cross. And they threw it up in his face again then. So that was primarily what the King James translators were focusing on. And Ellen White focuses on that four places in Desire of Ages. But in another part of the very same book, instead of quoting KJV, Ellen White quotes the Revised Version, and most English and American translations follow this track, in which the Greek word kenosis is legitimately translated emptied. Now, it can be translated legitimately without reputation, made himself of no reputation. It can also be translated legitimately emptied. And most of the modern translations go this route. And would you please notice, we've given you an extract here from Desire of Ages 22, where Ellen White quotes the Revised Version. He emptied himself, taking the form of a servant. And Ellen White, in Desire of Ages and elsewhere in her writings, develops what we might call a kenotic theology, demonstrating that Christ emptied himself temporarily of at least a half a dozen attributes of deity, and indicates further that one change was for eternity, in that he took human flesh in the incarnation, not just for the 33 years of his earthly sojourn, but also for eternity. Most of the things he emptied himself, he got back when he went back 33 years later. When I studied in 1958 or 59 in the seminary, maybe it was the second semester of the 58-59 school year, the seminary was still in Washington, I took a course in Christology from Dr. W.G.C. Murdoch, who later became the dean of our seminary here. And we spent some time in there on the kenotic theory. And he pointed out that this was a legitimate translation. Christ emptied himself. He gave us some background on the theology of kenosis. And he created a curiosity which has continued with me. And I started to make a collection of Ellen White quotations dealing with the emptying of the pre-existent Christ. And today, 25 years later, I have a collection of 4x6 cards, quotations, that's about an inch and a half thick. And I categorized them. I found about 7 or 8 categories of things, of which Jesus emptied himself when he came to this earth. Most of them he took back when he went back. It's an ongoing research project. Every once in a while I come across something new to add to my collection. So Ellen White took both the King James Version and the RV, Revised Version, and she used both renderings in the very same book because she wanted to make the different points that are both legitimately made by the different translators. I haven't looked at that in some time. He emptied himself of royal prerogatives. She speaks about his royal robe, his crown, his scepter. He emptied himself of his close personal association with his father. He emptied himself of his omniscience, his all-knowledge. When Jesus stood on the doorway of heaven to come to this world and made that statement which appears in the Psalms and which Paul reproduces in Hebrews, "Lo, I come to do thy will, O my God, yea, in the volume of the book it is written, to do thy will." When Jesus stood at the gateway of heaven to come down to this world, he saw the whole plan of salvation from first to last, and he knew how it was all going to end up. When he got down here, he did not have his all knowledge as the Son of God. Ellen White makes it very clear in Desire of Ages, each day the Father, Jesus made no plans for himself, and each day the Father made Jesus' plans for him and revealed them to him each day. One day, The father said, today you're going up to Sychar. You're going up to the well of Jacob. You're going to meet a woman. She's been married five times and living with a man now she's not married to. And she's going to try to do this and you're going to do that. And she's going to do this and you're going to do that. And so when Jesus got there, he was prepared. The only advance information that Jesus had when he was on this earth was that which a prophet could have because it was revealed by God. Incidentally, it is very interesting that she said, I perceive you are a prophet. And it was as a prophet. It was not as the divine Son of God that Jesus knew the background of that woman. It was revealed to him. He did not automatically know it because he was God. Again, Mrs. White said he laid down his omniscient, his omnipotence, his all power. She says flatly that when Jesus stilled the waves, the tempest on Galilee, he did not do it by his inherent power as the second person of the Godhead. He did it through the power of the angels. And she makes it clear that Jesus worked his miracles not because of his inherent power as God, but that he asked his Father, and the Father worked the miracle through the angels. He laid down his omniscience, his all-knowledge. He laid down his all-power. And he took those things up when he went back up. Well, she's got about seven or eight categories of things. It's an interesting study. Now, in the middle of page 137, under section B, we have another way that Ellen White, this time it isn't exactly the way she used translations, but she made her own translation in modern English. And John 20:17 is a good example. In the King James of John 20:17, Jesus is reported to have told Mary Magdalene on Easter, would you scratch the N out? That crept in. It's not Eastern, it's Easter. On Easter Sunday morning, touch me not, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. This creates an impression that Jesus considered that he would somehow have been defiled if Mary or any other human being had touched him prior to his ascertaining whether or not his sacrifice was accepted as sufficient by God the Father in heaven. Now, under point two, Ellen White probably knew nothing of the original biblical languages, but she had a corresponding advantage in that when she viewed these events in vision, she probably heard the dialogue in contemporary English vocabulary, or American vocabulary. She certainly didn't hear Jesus talking in Aramaic to Mary and Peter and James and John. It wouldn't have meant anything to her if she had. There was a translation into American language. So she was in a position to know when the rendering of the King James was archaic and therefore potentially misleading. And in this instance, Ellen White made her own translation, not beginning to quote the King James until after she had made her own correct and more accurate translation. And if you'll turn to the top of 138, I have reproduced a couple of paragraphs there so that you may see how Ellen White handled it. She does not quote the first part of that text in John, touch me not. Instead, she makes her own translation, detain me not. And then, and only then, does she go to quote the King James Version, for I am not yet ascended to my Father. I found that very, very interesting. All right, conclusion. Incidentally, under the numbered points of the conclusion, there are two number threes, so would you change the second three into four and the four into five? Point one. It is an undeniable fact that Ellen White used and approved the use of modern language versions of the Bible, where the newer rendering made more accurate the message being conveyed than the increasingly archaic verbiage of the King James Version. She used new translations. Again, there's a typographical error there. Take off that S on new. She used new translations almost immediately after they were published. And at times and places, she made her own private translation when it suited her penchant for accuracy in meaning. Secondly, such usage was in harmony with her philosophy and theology of inspiration and revelation, which stressed that accurate meaning was the goal of responsible biblical exegesis and study. Third, there have been various far-fetched theories of Jesuit infiltration among white estate staff, among other theories, as an explanation for the alleged substitution of misleading modern translations for the original KJV, which she reportedly chose. These are totally without foundation and are ludicrous on the face of them. There are people who are holding the KJV as the only Bible to use, and they've got to account for the fact Ellen White used some of these modern translations in her day, and so one of them has suggested that a Jesuit infiltrated into the White Estate, and without her knowing it, he changed all those texts of the Bible. This is not so. Point four. One can only speculate about the degree to which Ellen White would go were she alive today and privileged to have what we have, dozens of modern language translations, whereas in her day she was limited virtually to only about a half dozen. Five, pastors would still be well advised not to take their liberty too far in quoting modern versions from the pulpit, particularly if you have a lot of elderly people who are so familiar with the KJV that they would be uncomfortable with something else. Sensitivity to the feelings of older members would caution concerning the amount of quoting from modern language translations and versions. Now, let me share with you, in the 2 minutes that we have left for this period, two documents. This is a little booklet which was inserted in the Ministry Magazine of October 1975. It runs 16 pages and is entitled, Which Version Today? And it was written by Sakai Kubo, who is today the Dean of Atlantic Union College, I believe. Is that right? And Walter Specht, who is a retired professor of New Testament. And both of those men were in our seminary here when this came out in 1975. This is a summary synopsis of their book, which is entitled, and it's in the library here, So Many Versions... ? The subtitle is 20th Century English Versions of the Bible. It's published by Zondervan in 1975. And these 16 pages sort of summarize and synthesize the materials of that book. It is very interesting. It is very helpful. Then there was an article which appeared in Adventist Review of December 2, 1982, Adventist Review, by Ralph Blodgett, who was then the editor, or an associate editor, of These Times magazine, and I think is now one of the associates of the Signs of the Times, if I'm not mistaken. And Blodgett was writing about the New Reader's Digest Bible, another translation, and asked the question in the title of the article, Is it for Adventists? And the article appears on page 7, page 8, and page 9, of the December 2, 1982 Adventist Review. As far as I know, these are the two chief contributions in print to a consideration of the modern versions of the Scriptures. We have 1 minute and a half. Question? I think it was that we need to be careful. He concludes it by something subtitled An Overall Rating. The new book deserves high ratings for readability, the page-wide textual format, the elimination of verbosity and needless repetition, and the smoothly flowing narrative and expository portions. The book introductions, which fresh, that is the various introductions to each of the books of the Bible, while fresh and generally informative, reveal a liberal theological bias that dates many passages much later than conservative Christians would accept. Genesis is attributed to several authors hundreds of years after Moses, Leviticus to the 6th century B.C., and Daniel to 168 to 165 B.C. These biases earn the introductions an overall low grade. One serious flaw in the Digest edition, I believe, involves a complete omission of any book, chapter numbers whatsoever, not even in tiny type in the center margins, which is, of course, the way they were originally written. Without the brief index, this volume is very difficult to correlate with almost every other available Bible text. And he hopes, in parentheses, that the Reader's Digest will include some small print, unobtrusive chapter numbers, perhaps at the bottom of the pages in future editions. The omission of material that contains scriptural teachings is the principal drawback. As we have seen in his article, doctrinal omissions and alterations have occurred. The Digest editors need to listen to constructive criticism along this line as they plan future editions so the book can be more useful in its intended object to present the Bible message in an easy-to-read format. So he gives it a mixed reading. Some things it's good, some things it's bad, which incidentally is true of any of the translations and versions. Some of them have good things, and some of them have bad, like Topsy. When it was good, it was very, very good. When it was bad, it was terrible. Yes?
Present Sabbath School lesson, chapter 5 of John, last topic, verse 4, is interesting. That whosoever then first, after the troubling of the water, stepped in, was made whole of whatsoever disease he had.
Uh-huh.
This is eliminated in most of the modern translations, and Mrs. White says, and it was thought that whosoever.
Isn't that interesting? Mrs. White doesn't make it a declarative statement as John seems to, but Mrs. White indicates that this was more the common conception rather than the objective fact. I find that very interesting in Desire of Ages. Yes? Oh. All right. Yes.
Just a few days ago in the South Bend Tribune, they had an article about the first five books of Moses. They'd done a computer study on it, and of course, the Hebrew, I guess, was written, reverse order what we have, and there were no divisions between the letters. But they have done a computer study, and as a result of that, they said that they're giving more credence, the scholars are giving more credence to the thought that one author, Moses, wrote the whole Bible.
Yes, so a lot of the earlier conclusions of some of the higher critics are being reversed and revised by the higher critics themselves. And a lot of the predilections and predispositions of the critics creep into some of these things. But you know, I sat on this campus in 1973, the summer of 1973. We had a three-week workshop, which if you think the schedule here these last 2 weeks has been heavy, you should have been there then. We started at 8 o'clock in the morning and we finished at 9 o'clock at night. 3 solid weeks. This was the wearing out of the saints. And I heard Graham Maxwell take 2 hours. And of course, his specialty is New Testament. He got his doctorate in New Testament from the University of Chicago Divinity School. And he spent 2 solid hours showing how Ellen White, who obviously had very little knowledge of the original languages of the Bible, walked through a theological minefield and was a winner practically every time. It was one of the most exciting things I ever heard, where she could have made some mistakes based on less than accurate translations in KJV and in other versions, and how she absolutely walked through a theological minefield and never once the thing exploded on her. 2 hours, and I have never forgotten it. Yes? I don't think it is. You could write and ask him. It was presented here, and it was later presented a couple of years later at Newbold, England, when a similar seminar was held, but I don't think it is in print yet. I wish it were. I wish I had it. I only have my own rough notes. I took notes as fast as I could while it was being presented. Well, we've gone over a couple of minutes. The next session will begin at 9:30, and we hope all of you will be here to hear Dr. Olson make his presentation.
This concludes another lecture from the 1986 E.G. White Estate Prophetic Guidance Seminar held at Andrews University. As a service to the church and in cooperation with E.G. White Estate, this has been a special American Cassette Ministries production. International copyright, 1986, all rights reserved.
To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries have been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.